Last week on Main Menu, we devoted the entire program to Audible.com. We've had a phenomenal response to that program, and it's with great pleasure that this week we feature an interview with the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Audible.com, Don Katz. I have to apologize that the first long-distance carrier we attempted to do this interview with proved to be a little bit flaky, so the first 10 minutes or so of the interview is full of a little bit of breakup. But you'll find that after about 10 minutes, the audio improves substantially. So let's introduce Don Katz, CEO of Audible. Don, thanks for joining us. I was reading about the origins of Audible, and it's interesting to me how you got this idea, how you got involved with Audible, because, of course, you're a journalist by profession, and I understand was supposed to be writing a book on the technology revolution when you got the Audible bug.
That's right. I was an author for 20 years before founding Audible, and wrote every day of my life. And actually, my fourth book was going to be about the digital media revolution. And if you go back 7 or 8 years, you might remember that there was, particularly in the States, a lot of rhetoric about the convergence of the computer industry, the telephone industry, and the cable television industry. That was going to be the theme of the book. And in fact, it was really just rhetoric, and there wasn't a heck of a lot to write about at that time. I actually did cover something called the full-service network launch, which was Time Warner had taken over part of a town in Florida and wired it at tremendous expense to be kind of the interactive town of the future. But basically, it was just a demonstration site. And out of this, I became interested in various elements of potential for digital media distribution in the future. A couple things came together. One was that if you were author interested in business, were kind of aware of the extreme lack of economic rationality in the publishing model, which had to do with just the fact that the packaging and the product was so expensive and the distribution mechanisms were inefficient, and there were a tremendous amount of inefficiencies in the way product was returned from the shelves back from the retailer to the publisher, and so there was that. And then I was always interested in the spoken word as just a literary phenomenon. I jogged and listened to tapes of books and was aware of the growth of the audiobook industry, which had really gone from nothing to some measure, some $2 billion in sales in the United States. Over just about 10 years, and then my college roommate was a supercomputer designer, and at some point he was explaining algorithms to me and the way compression of audio could actually create these small digital files, particularly spoken word files versus music or video files. And I guess then there was a fourth element, which was that my work from magazines in particular began to appear often under other people's names all over the early internet and web. I'm aware that there was probably issues of the professional creative class protecting their work in the future, or at least figuring out how to get paid for it in the digital distribution. Somehow this all came together as the idea of Audible, which was really a vision of this digital inventory of thousands and thousands of audio books. And then the additive concept that periodicals, such as our morning Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, which obviously be difficult to get a tape to someone quickly enough in to drive to work listening to your morning newspaper, create digital product that had never existed before based on these brands of magazines and newspapers. So this seemed something of a pipe dream, but it was an idea that other people endorsed, and having led a company, although in my journalistic career, having looked over the shoulder of some of the great business creators of our time and written books about it, I partnered up with some people from the technology industry and raised a bit of money from Kleiner Perkins, which is a famous venture capital firm in California, and started the company.
You were one of the first people to understand that the whole advertising-driven dot-com bubble wasn't sustainable. And when you started, you bucked the trend, really. In fact, I think there was a competitor that has now gone under that was putting ads in the books and giving them away. And you decided that the only sustainable way was to make the books available for purchase. And it's fascinating what 5 or 6 years on that a lot of those guys are gone and here you still are and thriving.
Right. Yeah, there were several would-be competitors along the way. And it was interesting, very aggressive on a couple of fronts. One of the things was that because it was such a fascinating niche, listening to the spoken word, realized that it probably couldn't afford to have a multitude of technology platforms that confused the consumer. What I looked at to sort of think about that was the early electronic game industry, where multiple platforms that, and people kind of, the consumer held back for years, being the content creators didn't know which platform to develop for. The other example was VHS versus the beta video recording industry, where the platform issue. So we basically went out pretty aggressively, asked the content community to exclusively grant us rights for a period of time so that we could, you know, aggregate enough content to have the technology community support us, created a unified platform. And I think that gave us, you know, obviously a tremendous lead in the fact that the service was simply better. And then I think, you know, the unfortunate characteristic of the economic downturn and the bursting of the much talked about internet bubble left us basically as the strong player.
So,
you know, at some point we'll have more competitive services, but for right now, really nothing can compare what Audible offers the consumer.
The whole concept of taking the audio away, liberating yourself from being in front of the PC when you get this stuff, that's the compelling thing. Now that you've got that model working so well, can it be used in other areas besides spoken word material? Are you looking at expanding your core business in any way?
Well, it's interesting. We always developed it as a model and a technology that's extensible to other media types on one hand, which is that over time, the way I look at things now is that if you look at the various kinds of media that can be delivered to computer or delivered digitally in other ways, for instance, wirelessly, which we're working on and doing by the end of the AT&T wireless here in the States, is that you have text, which really, the whole ebook phenomenon is just not viable yet as a user experience. Reading on a screen is just not competitive with reading on a book for people at this point. Then you have music, which obviously has no user experience issues if you have a broadband connection and it's a pristine copy of music that comes with. But there's tremendous rights issues and business model issues. Probably all know the labels have resisted digital distribution and consequently the market in borrowing or stealing music over the web. And then there's video and software, which have tremendous potential for digital distribution, but at this point there's significant bandwidth issues because of the size of those files. Then you had sort of stuck in there the spoken word market, where we thought that we could both create technologies that work for people even in dial-up modems in an efficient way, and we also thought we could aggregate tremendous, leading rights portfolio of kind of content people listen to. So the model definitely is extended at the right time, and it's also meant to extend, I think, in terms of our ability to serve global populations and localize in other countries, where at this point we've got customers in 120 different countries, but there's a significant evidence that even in English-speaking countries that localizing it would probably make it more attractive to people. So there's no question that taking new steps. And meanwhile, we're always pushing original model of a tethered device that that you load up next to the computer and that take on the road. In fact, my original vision for that was printer sits on every desk next to a computer because people needed to liberate text that was inside their PCs, and there would be all these devices and taking what comes into your computer away, other mobile environments. But fairly recently we introduced burning of CDs, where you make your own CDs out of audible content from your PC, which is another element which at this point 35 or 40% of computers sold in the United States have the ability to burn CDs. And that's an important element of our business development, simply because you don't have to have a device, which is an incremental cost. And the other thing, as I mentioned, was wireless delivery is another platform that will take a little while because cellular phones now don't have the memory to capture audio. But the idea is that our software, which right now will wake up in the middle of the night and get your morning newspaper or your book, if you said it that way, used experiments now where it wakes up and gets a load of audio in the middle of the night, and the pocket PC, your PDA, which is equipped with a wireless modem, is ready to go and it hasn't been connected to the computer at all.
You were talking about the CD burning briefly. I'm interested in this because obviously you put a lot of effort of necessity into making sure that the digital rights management technology in Audible was pretty solid. Otherwise, the publishers wouldn't give you their stuff, I imagine. Isn't there some concern that once the Audible content gets on CD, it can then be turned into MP3 and end up on file sharing services and that kind of thing?
That's a very good question, and it's been a very interesting evolution in the world of protecting the content. And as I mentioned, coming from a world where I made my living from selling my wares as a content creator, I've always been extremely sensitive to this, and as have we. But from the very beginning, my pledge to the creative community was that I would protect their revenue. And that's a very different pledge than you hear in the world of music, for instance, where the idea is to lock away the content per se. And one of the issues in music with the paid services that are trying to get launched now is that it's a very consumer-unfriendly experience to have to fill out innumerable licenses and put your credit card in a few times. And it's like applying for a home loan mortgage or something to play a song in your computer. And I think that leads to some of the free downloads. So basically the answer is that we still have figured out a way to make it relatively secure in the sense that there is a control to the desktop, and the fact of the matter is when you do an audiobook on CD, you're going to be doing several different CDs. This is just audio CDs. We're not allowing MP3 CDs where you have a compressed file. This is just making the kind of audio CD you can slip into your car CD player. And the work involved of creating an upstream file there is simply the kind of thing that if you're going to, set your mind to, to stealing this, which people just don't tend to do from Audible, you probably could do it in other ways anyways, if that was your will. And so the point with us is that we've been able to take our content community through doing what we said we've done and delivering them ever-increasing revenue to, new platforms and new experiments at various points on the way. And, this is something that needed to happen, if for no other reason that so many cars are coming out now without cassette players. What we do now, of course, is we'll send any customer with a device they get from Audible, which of course they can get very low cost if they commit to our subscriptions, we'll send them a cassette adapter to put into the cassette player in their car, and then it takes over the stereo and plays through the car speakers. Well, we needed to have a way for people buying cars without cassettes to play it, and then of course there's a tremendous installed base. So, we're going to see what happens, but I do think that we're operating in a world of literary listening, where you have you have books, and you have, I think, the kinds of people listening have an awareness that if they actually steal this stuff, somebody on the other end who's worked hard to create it is the lesser. And I think there's just less of a will to thievery. In the music market, you have literally millions of people doing it every day who probably aren't even aware that it's intellectual property theft, and they look at it as sharing with their friends. And you just don't have that cultural phenomena with us. So there is a level of protection. You can burn it basically one point some number of times, which is a way to assure that if something happens with your blank media, you can do it over. But it's so far is working very well, and we haven't seen any evidence of any level of peer-to-peer sharing that would hurt either our business or our content providers.
Obviously, the audience that we're talking to now is a blind audience from around the world, and blind people have been using talking books for years. They were the original early adopters of this sort of thing. How conscious are you of that market, of the fact that there are blind people whose perhaps sole source of information is audiobooks?
Oh, I'm very, very aware of it, and it is something that I will admit to your audience right now that we, as a young company, haven't been able to address technologically as efficiently as we'd like to and we intend to in the future. It is clearly a service that we know very, very many customers who are using it who are reading impaired in various ways, and it's something that that we're very proud of, but we haven't been able to develop quite yet as friendly a website for the blind community as I would like to see. So it is something that we do intend to do. I don't think JAWS programs work as well as it should with the character of our website. So it's clearly a community that I'm personally involved with. Actually, I gave a keynote at our Reading for the Blind and Dyslexic organization here in New York.
Oh yes, yep.
A few weeks ago, and part of what my interest too in that community is just what I'm interested in too is just the intellectual integrity of listening and the power and evocation of literary material that is actually heard in and of itself. My own background as a writer, I trained with the famous American novelist Ralph Ellison, and he was a student of listening to literary language and the power of that. And I actually find myself giving speeches in the content community often about the historical integrity of the oral evocation of creativity, and the fact that text was really kind of an upstart technology that had its day in the 19th century, but that from the time of Plato, for many centuries, it was a suspect and upstart technology. The Greeks were dead set against writing as something that would atrophy memory and the ability to be intellectually active. And through the end of the time of St. Augustine, actually in the Christian world, you weren't only allowed to read out loud if you read at all, and that was again because of that. It was suspect to be silently reading. But basically, and plus there's a lot of research that shows that listening to material versus reading it, have about 50% of the population has much higher retention of what they're listening to, and we see this. We see a fascinating phenomenon of some very either complicated or what would be thought to be challenging material is often taken on by our listeners. You find baby boom peers of my own going back to reading classics, and very, very challenging scientific material is chosen in tremendous numbers. So I'm aware that there's an element of just the beauty of listening as in and of itself, which clearly is the way so many reading impaired people get their knowledge and become informed and entertained. So I'm happy that the service has the capacity to have content that you don't have on tape, even in the world of statutorily underwritten creation of content, which we have in the United States. And I'm happy about that, but I'm not as happy as I could be about our ability to serve the reading impaired population, although we are working on a research level with various organizations for next generation digital machinery, because one of the big things going on in the talking book world is the move to digitization, and anything we can do to be helpful, we are.
One of the things that I've mentioned to people who say to me, well, we've got a number of agencies providing material to blind people, why would we pay for content from Audible? And I think the issue is that the best sellers, the books that everyone else is reading, are generally available on Audible, and some of them unabridged. And I must admit, I tend to be a fan of the unabridged audio, because I keep wondering what I'm missing.
Right.
A lot of that is there, and it's available at the same time as everybody else is reading it and talking about it. And that's significant in terms of social inclusion, really.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And, I think that... We do find that just plain having bestsellers, and it is an interesting phenomenon, is that, there are, you mentioned the abridged versus unabridged. We have a tremendous swing to the unabridged, so much so that in the tens of thousands of people who come every day and download our audio, that we don't even bother to encode the abridged version of some books at this point, because the desire for the unabridged, because I think what happens is that in our world, where it's just a digital file that comes coursing down the through the internet onto your computer, that there isn't the need to have, in the case of a big unabridged book, 22 different cassette tapes apples to apples, that people would prefer the unabridged read. I will admit, though, that when I first got into reading the books as a jogger, and one of the things that I did want to do was, I had so many friends in the literary community coming out with books that I just didn't have time to read, that in just 3 hours I could know what was in a book and be able to discuss it with them without having actually to take the time to read it. So sometimes I think there is an efficiency level in the abridged book. I know that, feeling like I need to know what's in certain kinds of management texts that come out, I'm just as happy having the abridged version and knowing what the book's thesis is rather than the entire read. So I think that there's a level of utility in abridgments, but unabridged is definitely where it's going. And yes, I think just plain having, most of the books that are in the front of a bookstore is important for us. It's becoming something of a frustration, I will admit, in that we have such a deep and interesting collection. I think we have 150 different categories and of different kinds of content. And the internet is as brilliant as it is a difficult environment for organizing and merchandising and displaying that deeper list. And we're always trying to figure out ways to invite people to subscribe to emails that segregate the content into areas such as history listeners or science material listeners, so we can get what's important in those categories out to people. But ultimately, it's still just a square in front of you, and I think one of the reasons we sell so many bestsellers too is that that's what you see when you come to the homepage. But having said that, I'm always amazed by how deeply particularly the book catalog is penetrated. In fact, I was noticing in the statistics the other day that something on the order of 60% of the titles were taken by somebody over the course of a week, and there's, I think, 7,000 audiobooks.
Oh, yeah. Your comment about how many books there are brings me on to my next question, and that is, do you think you've hit the sweet spot in terms of the Audible listener plans? I find it terribly easy to get through my 2 books a month. You looking at other options?
We are always looking at new options, and just for your listeners who don't know, the way it works now is that the preferred program for most people is that you can come to Audible and pay us $15.95 American for any 2 audiobooks in the store every month. And we developed this at first as a way to get over the high price of the mobile listening device. And so you could actually, if you commit for 18 months to pay us $15.95, we'll give you an MP3 player that'll hold up to 20 hours of Audible content. There's also a $12.95 program, which is 1 audiobook and one of our 26 different subscription programs, which is anything from, as I mentioned, the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or Scientific American or Forbes, and we have our own sex columnists, and Robin Williams does a show every 2 weeks, and you can also time shift the key programs from our public radio environment, which includes, you know, things like Car Talk and Fresh Air and Garrison Keillor. So it's a, you know, it's a very inexpensive program compared to if people who purchase the tapes at retail. If you know, if you went and got the two leading bestsellers off the homepage today and went over to an American bookstore, you'd for what costs $15.95 at Audible, you'd probably have to pay $65 or $70 for the tape sets. And so that's been the model for about 20 months. And it's interesting, evolution-wise, when I started it, it was really much more of a bookstore where you could only just buy them each at retail, much like Amazon.com. But clearly the people looked at this as a service that was part of their life on a daily basis, almost like their paid television service. So we evolved to that model. So I think it served its purpose, and it's, it makes sense to people. But, you know, how many books you should be getting or whether or not we should be having, you know, a way to have a significant discount out of, off of any subsequent purchase you make if you need more books than the two is something that we're closely observing. And I wouldn't be surprised if by the late summer we'll have a more pricing or a different kind of pricing model that serves a need, because we do have about a quarter of the customers continue to buy product above their, you know, above their subscription allotment.
Yeah, they're hooked.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. On the other hand, there are people who can't, who just don't have enough listening time to get through the two books, and we want to also figure out a way to have a scalable program for them too. I mean, it's somewhat, you know, gated in the States by people's driving time. You know, you mentioned that mobility was key, and the original vision of the idea was somewhat inspired by some amazing statistics. I don't know if it's widely known, but in the United States, where we, you know, we have, I think, about 120 million people or so who go to work every day, 97 million of them drive to work by themselves. And according to our Department of Transportation, something on the order of 600 million hours per week is spent in the United States sitting in traffic. So this seemed to be just a tremendous addressable market, as they say in business terms.
Absolutely.
And what was interesting is that if you look at the entire American information and media economy, which is said to be something like $350 billion in spending, 60% of it is paid for by the consumer. It's dollars out of people's pockets. And if you and the rest of it's advertising, the 40% of the advertising spending. And if you look at the early internet, it's skewed entirely to free content and advertising-supported services. And it was clear to me that if the web matured, that the better content would, you know, be supported by people, you know, paying for things. You get what you pay for is pretty clear in the world of content. And if you looked at radio, in fact, most media types break down to be about 50-50 or 60-40 in terms of the consumer paying in advertising. At this point, that's where the newspaper industry and the magazine industry is, of subscriptions versus ads. And it's certainly where, in America, 65% of television revenue is paid for by people having their premium cable access, as opposed to the old model of advertising. And radio is really the last preserve of an all-advertising marketplace. And it, in the States, where, you know, public radio has its following, but it's still largely a commercial marketplace, then there was really no way to have a personalized, paid, more personalized programming marketplace. So the idea was to kind of create that next to the radio, and take the audio books, which were kind of misplaced in some ways in the back of bookshops for the consumer, and position it against the radio.
Yeah, and the all things considered type situation where people will say, well, I can listen to that on NPR, but I guess it comes back to the busy executive who may want a quick skim of the news, and if there's an article that has no interest to them at all, they can just push the button to skip to the next item in Audible.
Yeah, that was it's very interesting, because I argued with my early technology partner in starting the company. I mean, he just couldn't understand why I wanted to go after the shifting of public radio programming to for a fee for people to, you know, if they wanted to listen to something in their driving time rather than missing a program that played at a fixed time on the radio. And my argument was that people spent, many dollars more to get a package via Federal Express to someone the next day versus the, you know, 30 cents for a stamp at that point. And that there was a premium in that some people would pay for the convenience of having something when they wanted it. And as you say, there's some internal advantages to having digital skipping points between, you know, points in an interview you might find tedious and you can skip through it. And the skipping actually is something that is very, very serviceable in the text material. When you get the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, you can almost have a text-like experience of skipping to the top of each story and listening to what it's about, and you could even, you know, attack the newspaper the way people do naturally. If you want to do the sports section first, do that, and then go back and hit the front page.
When I mentioned that I was going to be speaking with you, I got a couple of questions from listeners. One of them I'd be interested in your reaction to particularly, because blind people, having worked with audiobooks for years and years, are very quick processors of audio. And a lot of the audio players for blind people have ways of speeding up the reading of material without actually changing the pitch. It's a kind of compression of the speech. Have you had any call for that in audible players?
You know, we have, but it's not as much as I would have expected at the beginning. And, you know, with a company that's growing quickly and with so much to do with make the service better and to get to the next stage of our development and growth as a company, you always are prioritizing. And I would have thought by now that the demand, and we're always going out and trying to get a sense of what people want next in terms of the service evolving. There are, you know, right at this point, very, very good and sophisticated codecs, algorithms for compressing the audio, which would allow the speeding up of the content without changing the voice tones and compromising the way the reading sounds, which is an innovation of digital over analog. But there hasn't been a tremendous amount of demand for it. I mean, sometimes I think people in the reading impaired community probably are more adept at taking it in more quickly and actually would like to have it, as quickly as they can intellectually process. But maybe it's just because we're introducing so many people to listening and are so novice and are just, pleased or amazed that they can actually be using their time listening to material of this quality. But we don't have as much demand as I would have thought by now. So it is something that, you know, we've definitely talked about and that, you know, we know we will integrate at some point. But for right now, it's not something that we have in the very near future. But we're definitely aware of it.
All right. Another question I received was that people find the book that they really want to read and they choose to purchase, and then they get a message to say that the book they've chosen isn't available for purchase in their country. What causes that?
That's one of those things that we just plain had to live with, having to do with, you know, having a relatively old-fashioned rights issue, which is just that when books are originally published, they very often are published, and the rights that create that particular work are gated to particular geographic areas. It sometimes just happens that you sign up and the publishing contract is for all North American rights or all English language rights or even, you know, limited rights to certain geographical locations. And it's just the way the rights tend to be. So when we started the company, we actually had to create elements of the technology which it's a limited number of titles, but there are significant numbers in there that unfortunately we cannot ship, you know, theoretically. I mean, let's face it, somebody signs up in Sydney and takes their computer to you know, Germany. It's not like we actually know that. I mean, you know, the old joke in the internet, nobody knows if you're a dog. I mean, it's just where you originally sign up. But we're still unfortunately have to you know, tell people in certain locations that certain titles are not cleared, and we're always working to clear ever more, you know, rights, and to make sure that the rights we have are clean on a global basis. And similarly, the few titles that people really do want that we haven't been able to we tirelessly go after them and try to convince the people who hold the rights that this way of doing things is good and that they shouldn't be afraid of it and should be part of this movement. But we do unfortunately have to block certain rights, and we're aware that it is really bothersome to people, and you know, particularly in countries that aren't the United States. It doesn't, you know, almost everything we have is available to anyone in the United States. It's just really a question of places like Australia, New Zealand, to a lesser extent the UK, and then certain of our Asian customers.
And just finally, can you give us a bit of a glimpse into the future? Where is Audible heading? What's your vision for, I guess, the immediate to long-term future?
Well, in the immediate future, I think the main things for Audible as a business can be, quite frankly, broken down into you know, three main thrusts, and I can talk a bit about technologically where I think it's going. But the main thing for Audible is to make the system, you know, easier and easier to use and easier to understand for people who visit us, so that they can become customers and happily so. And we're better than, and you, as you know, you've been a customer from the beginning, basically. Mm. It has gotten easier, and the communication is more comprehensible. At the very beginning, quite frankly, it was largely a population of people who were very handy around the computer and had an interest in how computers worked, and almost nothing you put in the way in terms of the challenges of using it tended to keep people back because they were so good technologically.
Yeah.
And that's really, really changed. The person coming to Audible to check us out on a daily basis now is just basically a busy, intelligent person who happens to have web access. And as you know, there's many millions of those people, and they are a generalized audience as opposed to the early adopters who came at the very beginning. And we need to make the system just easier for them to understand and to feel comfortable with, and we're working that all the time. The second thing is we just need to increase the awareness of the what Audible is to people so that we can grow. And, you know, that's really is a challenge. I mean, the world of creating a brand, by some estimates, costs, you know, $20 or $30 million in advertising to create a brand in the United States alone. We are a company that was probably, unfortunately, grouped into the internet company class that, you know, was so highly valued for a period of time, and we went into the public markets in the United States in 1999. You almost had to at that point, because there was such a desire to finance companies like that used the internet, although ours, I would argue, used it in a more traditional way. We were simply taking the inefficiencies out of a market that existed. But you know, we went public, and you know, the valuations of a company like ours now are so low that we're not going to be spending that kind of money on television advertising campaigns. So we have to be very intelligent about how we communicate and teach people about what Audible is. And there, you know, what's interesting too, from CD burning, for instance, is it is opening up tremendous new opportunities to have products in retail stores, and to partner with the companies that put out blank media that people press their own CDs with, and even computer makers where they have burners, they might want to have Audible content. So we're very excited about growing, but we, you know, point one, making it easier, point two, making more people aware of it, leads to point three, which is this year we plan to become a profitable and self-sustaining company, which obviously is the goal of any young company, and we're kind of monolithically focused on that in the near term. And we're, you know, we're growing very, very quickly. by any company standards. So we're excited about getting to that point. And I guess in terms of the future, on a more generalized plane, is that I do see us moving into the wireless delivery of our content. And I think that there's, for various reasons, the spoken word will be first and foremost there, because the compressibility of the files allows it to go through the 2.5G, the earlier stage bandwidth that the carriers are setting up before the, you know, the future of broadband, full broadband is there. So I'm excited about that, because the fact of the matter is that in terms of the ease of use elements, as much as we love our computers, there are elements of just the operating system and the interoperability of computers that make for technical problems that irritate people. So the idea of just plain having a listening device that is loaded up with what you want without having to be tethered to the computer, I think, is an important part of the future.
It's been fascinating speaking with you, and we will have already, by the time we play this interview, done a comprehensive demonstration of Audible, so that blind people are more comfortable, hopefully, as a result of getting around the site. And I appreciate your time.
This is great. I've enjoyed talking to you, Jonathan, and please, anyone in your listenership that wants to communicate with us or me personally, I'm at dcatz@audible.com, and we really do like to hear from people.